Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak to you tonight. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming to speak to you and Darwin Evolving and about your inner fish. With the metaphor of your inner fish, what I'm really trying to capture is the notion that in every part of our bodies, in every organ, every tissue, every cell, and in every gene, in some way, in our bodies, we contain over 3.5 billion years of the history of life. What that means is much of the human story, understanding why we look the way we do, understanding why we're put together the way we are, involves understanding the bodies, the embryos, the DNA, and the fossils of other creatures. And those other creatures include pretty much all of life on the planet. Includes everything from primates to other mammals, to lizards, to flies, to worms, even fish and jellyfish. Now, my entree to this is decidedly fish-oriented, but I could have given you, I could have called this, you know, your inner fly to reflect the metaphor of our shared history with flies. But really, where I entered here in terms of thinking about your inner fish began in graduate school. With this diagram in a graduate seminar that I took on the transition from life in water to life on land. And you see this diagram here from one of my predecessors at the University of Chicago, Len Radinsky. He put out a textbook in 1987, and my professor in graduate school at the time had the rough drafts of this illustration, and he showed it to the seminar. And I remember looking at this diagram thinking, golly gee, what a first-class scientific problem, the transition from life in water to life on land. What you see on top is a lobe-finned fish. These are creatures that first appear in the fossil record about 390 or so million years ago. And you see on the bottom an early limbed animal, an early tetrapod. And this is a creature, a cartoon of a creature, known from Greenland, and it's from rocks that are about 365, 363 million years old. And you can see, look at the difference between these two. It's an enormous difference between a lobe-finned fish and a limbed animal, these tetrapods. And I thought, well, golly, this would be a great area to spend my career on, which is try to bridge this gap in understanding how this fish, which lived in water, breathes, moves around, feeds, excretes, does everything in water, evolved a lineage that led to descendants that live on land. Everything's entirely different from the ecology to the bodies. How did this happen? Well, we have lots of tools in our toolkit to understand how this transition happened. And what I want to give you a sense of is what those tools are, and probably the major tool that I've been spending quite a bit of time on in the last 20 years is finding fossils. That is, we can actually find fossils that bridge this gap. So I set off in graduate school with the goal in life to find fossils that bridge this gap between lobe-finned fish and limbed animal. So I did what fossil finders have done for over a century and a half before me, and that is apply three simple rules to find new places to look for fossils. That is, when we look for places, new places in the world to look for fossils, we look for places in the world that have really three properties. That have rocks of the right age, to answer the question we're interested in. So I told you here I'm interested in the transition from life in water to life in land. These things first appear around 390. This thing's about 365-ish. You know, rocks in that window would be perfect. So rocks of the right age. You look for rocks of the right type. Not every rock preserves fossils. For lots of reasons, because the rocks may have destroyed those fossils during the process, during the history of those rocks, or the creatures may not have lived in the environment in which the rocks were formed. So as paleontologists, we understand after a while the kinds of rocks and environments, ancient environments, that are most likely to produce critters, and so that's one thing we look for, rocks of the right type. But it does me no good if my wonderful rocks of the right age and the right type are buried 5 miles underground. There's the third variable, is those rocks have to be exposed to the surface for us to have access to. So when you go through the pages of National Geographic, you know, where are the paleontologists typically working? In deserts, where the naked bedrock actually exposes bones as they weather out of the rock. So that's what we do, look for places in the world that have rocks of the right age, right type, and that are exposed to the surface. There's a fourth variable I didn't tell you about, which is the all-important one, and that's money, i.e. lack of money. And what happened was, I graduated in graduate school and then began my first academic job at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And it's here in the southeastern corner of the state. You know, as a new assistant professor, I couldn't really take a whole bunch of risks, and nor did I have one of these giant startup packages that they give junior professors nowadays. And what I wanted was a research program that could be done on the cheap and actually off of my station wagon, you know, the turnpike tolls and gas money, something locally. So I dug out a geological map of Pennsylvania, and this is a geological map of the state of Pennsylvania stripped of everything unimportant. And what you see here is Devonian, and these are rocks more or less of the right age. This is the age of fishes in that window that I was describing to you before. And you can see in this purplish is where Devonian rocks have been mapped in the state of Pennsylvania. So it became clear to me within a 3-hour drive of my, you know, my university in Philadelphia, I had access to Devonian age rocks. It got better, because when you look at the geological reconstruction of what Pennsylvania looked like 365 million years ago, it's helpful to think that it's very different from what it is today. To think about what Pennsylvania looked like 365 million years ago, get Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Philadelphia out of your brain and think Amazon Delta. This is a cartoon of what Pennsylvania looked like at this time period, 365 million years ago. A giant delta system with mountains, highlands to the east, an inland sea to the west, where Pittsburgh and Cleveland are today, and a series of rivers that drain from east, more or less drain from east to west. Now, if you're a paleontologist interested in finding fossils that, you know, bridge the gap between life in water and life on land, this is perfect, because you can sample ancient seaways, ancient estuaries, all the way to different parts of the river environments, the fluvial environments. There was another piece of luck, and that is I had a new graduate student who joined me, and this was taken just last year, Ted Deschler, who was a graduate student who joined my lab looking for a PhD thesis, and really this, in 1990, began a collaboration that's lasted over 18 years. Ted and I have been working together, and we started in Pennsylvania. So I said Pennsylvania has rocks more or less of the right age, rocks of the right type. There's one big problem for paleontologists is that Pennsylvania is not a desert. That is, the research program I had with Ted was to follow the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation around as they made new roads. Because the only exposures in Pennsylvania are road cuts, stream cuts, railroad cuts, and so forth. This turns out to be one of our best sites. It's on it's an hour north of State College, Pennsylvania, along Route Run 20. Here you see a human being for scale right there. It's a red hill in Pennsylvania, and so the name of this road cut is Red Hill, Pennsylvania. We're not very clever. And what you have is a series of strata. These are the layers here. And if you were to look very carefully at these, what you'd see is that these are ancient streams and rivers. And in fact, each different parts of these would look like you had a stream cut in cross-section, where you'd see the pebbles and cobbles in the center and the fines laterally, and you can actually watch the evolution of these streams and rivers as they meander in this road cut here, in these layers. It's really remarkable geologically. It's even better for fossils, because as soon as we got there in 1991, we started to find fossils, like teeth the size of railroad spikes, lots of them. Soon thereafter, we started to find jaws of these creatures. This is the front end. These jaws are as long as your arm. This is just the front end here, with teeth as long as your thumb. The whole animals that we were beginning to pull out in bits and pieces were 16-foot-long predatory fish. So these giant monsters are coming out of the road cuts in Pennsylvania while trucks are whizzing by, you know, waving to us. But we started to pull out, it was a wonderful sight, because we started to pull out all kinds of other fish. This is a body of a lobe-finned fish. Here you see its scales. This is a squashed head. Okay, it's a neat fish, though, because its external armor is a lot like, it's very shiny. It has like an enamel-like structure. Then, by about 1993, we started to find limb bones of early tetrapods, early limbed animals. And this is one example. This is a humerus, upper arm bone. Okay, and what you see here is how we depict it scientifically in a journal article in six views. Okay, so this is the same bone shown in six views. What was absolutely great about this humerus, this upper arm bone, is that it was extremely well preserved, and it enabled direct comparisons to other limbed animals that were known from Greenland at the time. Okay, and even though it was a single bone, we were able to tell a lot about the posture of the animal and how it supported itself and so forth. That is, one bone can be a window into the lifestyle of an animal. And in fact, if you're going to choose one bone in a tetrapod, a humerus upper arm bone is a particularly good one. And so over time, We were able to reconstruct what these road cuts in Pennsylvania looked like 365 million years ago. And this is a reconstruction we did with National Geographic in the 90s. And we're pulling out some of the earliest forests, some trees, this creature known as Archaeopteryx, lots of shrubby kinds of land-living plants. So it's a very rich flora. Invertebrates of different kinds, sort of scorpion-like things, spider-like things. And then, in this small, shallow stream, what you have are those monstrous fish I was telling you about before, lots of different kinds of armored fish, and then, as I showed you, bits and pieces of early limbed animals. So it was really remarkable. We were able to beginning to piece together the flora and fauna, indeed, general pieces of this ecosystem of this ancient delta system. But we had a problem. And the problem was, remember my goal here was to sort of tell us, you find intermediates in the shift from life in water to life on land, or at least a fish. And what we were really finding were already very derived or advanced kinds of creatures. We were finding limbed animals already, which were highly specialized in rocks about 365 million years old. It became very clear that we were in the wrong time period, that we had to shift our focus. So let me just step back a bit and describe some of the anatomy we want to explain, and then how we went about explaining it. So you can see this lobe-finned fish on top and this limbed animal on the bottom. And you can see lots of differences among these, between these guys. The fish on top has a conical head with eyes on either side, whereas the limbed animal on the bottom has almost like a crocodilian-like head, you know, a flattish head with eyes on top. In fact, the proportions of this head are changing, too. You can see the front end is elongating in the limbed animal relative to the back end when you compare it to the fish. So the proportions are changing. It's getting flatter. One other thing that's changing is you'll notice this fish here doesn't have a neck. Its head is connected to its shoulder by a series of bones. So when a fish wants to move around and look around, move its head and eyes and so forth, it has to swim around in three-dimensional space. Fish don't have necks. Whereas the earliest land-living animals have a neck where the head is separate from the shoulder and can move independently of it. And I can give you a long list of features that differ between this fish and limbed animal, but obviously one of the biggest ones is fish have fins with fin rays, and limbed animals, as the name implies, have limbs with fingers and toes and wrists and ankles. In Pennsylvania, we were finding bits and pieces of these guys on the bottom. We weren't finding creatures with intermediate anatomies, transitional creatures. What it became very clear is what we had is to fill this gap in the evolutionary tree. You are here. You're a limbed animal along with all these other creatures. And these are the various lobe-finned fish that are successively more closely related to limbed animals. What we really needed were creatures at this cusp here between a conical head and a flat-headed form, finned form, and limbed form, and so forth. So if we looked at the ecosystems and we mapped them out stratigraphically, it became pretty clear that what you see is a simple pattern. That is, these lobe-finned fish have their first appearances in the fossil record down here, 390 to 380 million years ago. At least that's what we knew at the time. Some of these lineages continue all the way up. The earliest known limbed animals appear here at about 363, 365 million years ago. But there was a giant gap in our knowledge. And in fact, the biggest gap existed about 375 million years ago, where there were some quasi-flat-headed fish known in a fauna from Latvia. But they were only known bits and pieces at the time. What we really needed was to flesh this out. So back to the drawing board, looking for places in the world that have rocks of the right age, rocks of the right type, and rocks that are preserved at the surface. This was we had ideas to work in the American West, ideas to work in Brazil. We had one crazy idea to work in Antarctica. But then everything changed one day in my office at Penn in the winter of 1998. And this is total serendipity. Ted and I were having an argument. And to settle the argument, I pulled out this, a college geology textbook. This is the book, Evolution of the Earth by Dott and Batten, second edition. It's now in the eighth or ninth edition, something like that. We settled the argument, and you know, we're sitting around chewing the fat after the discussion, and I'm turning the pages of the book, and I hit a diagram which was to change the course of our research. And it's this diagram from this introductory textbook, and I want to spend a minute on it. It says Upper Devonian Sedimentary Facies. These are rocks that are maybe of the right age and maybe of the right type. And what you see here is a map of North America, United States, and superimposed on that map is an interpretation of the environment that these Devonian age rocks formed in. So the legend goes that the western part of North America was an ancient Devonian sea. Yet these authors identified three regions that had ancient delta systems back in the upper Devonian. One of them, and I've shown them in red here, one of them was in the eastern part of the United States. Well, that's what we already knew about. That's the Catskill Project. And that's those road cuts I was showing you before. There's this one in East Greenland. Well, that has been well studied since the 20s and 30s. You remember that cartoon I showed you of a limbed vertebrate, a tetrapod? That was a creature that was taken from these Devonian age rocks in East Greenland. But then what stopped us in our tracks, obviously, is where I'm going, as you could see, is this area here, extending 1,500 kilometers east to west across the Canadian Arctic, was mapped as an ancient Devonian delta system, which had another variable which I hadn't told you about, which is really important to me, which was that it was completely unexplored by any of my paleontological colleagues. So it had everything. So this all happened in the winter of 1998, and we set off that in the morning, and we set off that morning to the library. And indulge me as I tell you a little story about how this was all this happened. Let's cut back to the 1800s, in the 1890s. And let's cut back to this, one of the most famous wooden sailing vessels of all time in exploration. This is the Fram, a Norwegian vessel. Fram means forward in Norwegian. It was designed in the 1890s by a guy named Colin Archer under the orders of Nansen, who was one of the great Arctic explorers. Nansen designed this ship to carry a small crew farthest north. Remember, everyone was trying to get to the North Pole at this time period? Well, Nansen had an idea to sit on this boat and carry the Arctic currents up north, and this boat was designed to withstand great pressures in the Arctic ice. Well, this boat was later, and after the 1890s, by 1920, it was used by Admundson in his conquest of the South Pole, which was a successful. So it was used in a farthest south expedition and a farthest north expedition. But in the interim, around 1899, it took this crew here of hardy Norwegians up to what is now known as the Canadian Arctic. And they overwintered there for 4 years. Okay, now this crew here, and this is the leader, Otto Sverdrup, who was a great sailor. I can't imagine there were a whole lot of jokes around the dinner table with Otto Sverdrup at the helm. One of the heroes of our story is the youngest member of this expedition, which was Per Schei. What these guys did is they sailed. This is here's Greenland. Here's Ellesmere Island. So the North Pole would be just off the screen here. What this is, they overwintered here in these fjords. You see these fjords here in southern Ellesmere Island? They overwintered there. And what they did is, as they overwintered, Schei would get off, as the ship's naturalist, get off the boat and collect stuff, just like Darwin. And he'd collect the rocks and the bugs and the plants. And this is Per Schei here. It turns out Per Schei, in one of these fjords, this is a diagram of the fjord here, and these are his geological maps of the fjord, collected bits and pieces of fossil fish. Unfortunately, this collection was to be largely ignored or unknown for a long period of time because Per Schei was unable to describe it himself. He passed away about 2 years after the expedition returned back to port. Cut forward about 70 years, and you have this gentleman here, Ashton Embry, who is sort of the main geological mapper for the Canadian Geological Survey in Calgary, the main mapper for the Canadian Arctic. He was sent off on expeditions to map the geology of the Canadian Arctic islands. This is the fundamental stuff. These maps are the fundamental things that make my work possible. In fact, make much of oil and gas geology possible. In fact, make much of field geology possible. Ashton produced a paper, this one paper, the middle plastic wedge of the Franklinian geosyncline. Why am I showing this? Because one page defined the research. This one page from Ashton's paper had this bit on the age, where he's describing the age of these rocks. He says, the available data indicate an age of early to middle Franian. Do you remember the question mark I showed you before? This is the question mark, more or less, in age. Then it got better, and this is what stopped us in our tracks. So when he describes the rocks, he says this formation, which is called the Fram Formation, is similar to the Catskill Formation of Pennsylvania. So here we had rocks at the question mark, which were similar to our rocks in Pennsylvania. It was perfect. And indeed, in looking at some of Ashton's illustrations, these are the kinds of exposures you love as a paleontologist. So Ted and I were incredibly excited. This all happened in one morning in 1998. So we did what anybody would do under these circumstances. We went to lunch. And went to a Chinese place down the hall from my down the street from my office. And I had a fortune cookie. And I opened the fortune cookie, and it said, I kid you not, soon you will be at the top of the world. So I was like, okay, we're out of here. So there was a higher power at work. So to get to Ashton's map, so basically here we are. This is the North Pole here. This is Nunavut territory of Canada. Let's zoom into Ellesmere Island, which is this island here. So zoom into Ellesmere. That's this. So mapped across Ellesmere and the western part of the Arctic are these Devonian Age rocks. This formation here, which is the one that's similar to the Catskill Formation of Pennsylvania, is the Fromm Formation, named after that boat I showed you before. It's significantly earlier, about 10 to 12 million years earlier, than the earliest known limbed animals, which appear up here in rocks elsewhere in the world. So it was perfect. Rocks at the question mark of the right type. The problem is, I can't just get in my station wagon and drive to it anymore. It's no longer just like a quick hit. It's here, so it's far away. Not only that, it's up in the north, near the North Pole. A whole new set of challenges kicked in for us because, you know, when you work in these areas here, you're dealing with areas that are daylight 24 hours a day in the summer. They're dark 24 hours a day in the winter. It's highly remote. There are polar bears up there. Polar bears eat people. It's a very... So the logistics become a real limiting factor here. To give you a sense of how limiting it is, this is a picture of the nearest town to our fossil sites, and this is a picture of that town, a settlement of about 170 people taken in spring. Okay, so that's Greece Fjord, Nunavut. So what we do is we get around through this dance of tundra craft, airplanes, and helicopters. These planes actually land on the tundra. They have a stall speed of 55 miles an hour, which is very unnatural when you take off or land in them. But we're so remote, we're farther than a tank of gas for these helicopters, so these planes have to set up fuel caches for us. And we have to bring in all our food, we have to bring everything out, and so forth. It's really, it's very limiting having to use these aircraft. And indeed, it limits the science we can do because fossils are heavy, right? Fossils are like rocks. And means we can only bring back a small fraction of what we find every year in the field. So because weights are so limiting, this is kind of what camp and crew looks like before we pack it up. All our food goes in these tubs, which are sealed up, which is good because the polar bears have good noses and they live out here. And we really limit the amount of weight that comes in on each expedition. So we began, we had the fortune cookie in 1998, and our first expedition was in 1999, and we began in the western part of the Arctic here, in Bathurst Island and Melville Island. And here you can see what camp looks like. We have a cook tent, and we have these personal tents. There are high winds there, so these tents will stay up in high winds. These tents don't stay up in high winds, so I've chased this all over the Arctic. But we set up at the base of these large snowfields, and you get water directly from the snowfields as they melt. But basically what it is we get out each morning and walk over the rocks. And as we look for bones that are weathering out on the surface. This first year's expedition, 1999, was a bust in a lot of ways. We didn't find what we were looking for. And as we looked at the geology, it became pretty clear we were in deep water sediments, sort of an ancient seaway. And what we had to do was get more into the river systems. So if we use the geological reconstruction, it's pretty clear that we had to go from the ancient oceans to the ancient streams, which meant in this delta system, we had to go east. So east we went. We went to southern Ellesmere Island here in 2000. That's to this portion here. This is what southern Ellesmere looked like. It's more mountainous, so we were able to have better exposures, actually. They were fresher rocks. And as soon as we moved east, we started to find fossil bones. And we started to find fossil bones of lobe-finned fish. The problem with the Arctic is getting around is a chore. You have no perspective. So when anybody comes to first time, you'd say, look across the stream and say, oh, yeah, I could hike to the top of that hill there, no problem. There are no trees for perspective. That hill's like 8 to 10 miles away. So, yeah, you can do it. It's going to take you pretty much the full day. And also getting around to the Arctic is hard. So just actually learning the Arctic weathering patterns and geology and the ability to walk around was not trivial. Life in the Arctic, you know, this is a tent. We have windstorms that come in, so I build a wind wall around my tent. Because the polar firearms and satellite phones and so forth. So just to give you a sense of what we're looking for and how the work goes, we walk around all day, and then what we look for are trails of bone weathering out on the surface. And I don't know if you can see this in this light here, but everything you see here, see this shiny trail here? See the rock? And there's a trail of shiny pebbles? That's all bone. Okay, and that's what you're looking for, is the trail of bone weathering out of the rock, and you chase it up until you find, you know, that's where it's weathering out of the rock lens and so forth. Dig in and hopefully you'll find a skeleton. And so if you zoom in, this is kind of what it looks like. Here's the sort of the mud, and each of these white things is a bone. And after a while, you get pretty good at pattern recognition of telling the difference between the native rock and the bones. Okay, and in each place, it's subtly different. The big discovery happened here, and it happened with a college undergraduate who joined us to learn to be a paleontologist. He was thinking about going to graduate school. Young Jason Downs, a college undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, joined the expedition. And this is Jason. And the morning he was to make his discovery and the place he was going to do it, it was somebody, this picture was taken by Ted just randomly after lunch. What was to happen is, here's Jason, he's going to walk away for the next few hours after lunch. Then at some point, unknown to us, Jason was going to walk over this layer right here. Now, we didn't know this at the time because the day had gone by and we had returned to camp, and Jason didn't show up at camp by dinner time. And we all got very worried about Jason, and we were asking, you know, the questions, you know, it's concerning when the youngest crew member is not returning to camp. We usually go out in pairs, and he got separated. But the reason why Jason was late became pretty clear when we heard, you know, footsteps come up. He enters the tent, and as he entered the tent, he was going through every pocket of his parka and rain pants were filled with fossil bones. And he'd pull them out on the surface of the table. And these are those fossil bones we took a picture that night. So it turns out that Jason was to walk around later in the day and walk over this layer here. And this layer, which you can't see with this light shining on it, is actually slightly whitish-green. And the reason why it's slightly whitish-green is because it's a carpet of fish bones weathering out in place that Jason had found. So we saw this in the tent. He had little digital photos of it. And, you know, it's daylight 24 hours a day in the Arctic. So we said, dinner can wait. You know, we grabbed chocolate bars and, you know, Cliff bars and ran to Jason's site. And this is us at 3 in the morning that night crawling Jason's site to find the layer where his bones were coming from. It took us a year to find the layer. It was not... weather and all kinds of stuff happened. But this is... the layer ultimately, and this is Ted here, we exposed the layer. And as we exposed the layer, that carpet of fish fragments was produced by skeleton after skeleton of fossil fish buried one on top of the other. So that was really fun. We worked it for a while. And this is the hole as it looked in 2006. This is Jason's little site there. But the big discoveries really happened here. And in Jason's site, we were picking rocks away, and my colleague here, Steve Gates, he was a professor at Brown University, picked a rock from right here, pulled it out and said, hey guys, what's this? And as soon as we saw it, we knew we found what we were looking for, and I brought the cast of this thing here. What you see here, here's the rock, and here, do you see there's like a little V? Like a little V here, and there's a little slit there? When we looked at that V, well, you can see there's little teeth in there, teeth here. It's the snout of a fish, and not just any fish, the snout of a flat-headed fish. So here we had, sticking out of us in these rocks, the snout of a flat-headed fish. Remember I told you, conical head to flathead? Go to the question mark, maybe we'll find a flat-headed fish. Boom, all of a sudden we had a flat-headed fish staring out at us from the rock. And so basically we had to spend the rest of the time roughing this thing out, which Steve did in masterful detail here. Not bring the bone out, we bring it as a sort of encased in rock, still wrapped in plaster. As we did that, this is Farish Jenkins from Harvard here. As underneath Farish, we found another one of these specimens. Then down and lower in the hole, I found another specimen. Over a short period of time, we now had four of these flat-headed fish specimens, varying in size from about 4 feet to 9 feet long. And they have to come home on the bottom of a helicopter because they're encased in plaster. So we got these back to the laboratory and opened the plaster. And here's where the preparators take over. In the laboratory, under a microscope, with a needle in a pin vise, the preparators remove the rock grain by grain to expose bones. This particular thing is Steve's specimen. Remember that V I showed you before? This is after 2 months of preparation. Well, this is what it started to look like. You could see, it looks like almost you have a top of a skull. Here you have one orbit, one eye. Here's another one. Started to emerge over itself. Now remember, this is when in south central Pennsylvania, a trial was going on in Dover, Pennsylvania, where there was, they were suing about intelligent design in the schools. After another 5 months, this is what started to reveal itself. Here you can see you start to have a flat head. Here's one orbit. Here's another orbit. Hey, look, here's a shoulder. Here's another shoulder. Golly, it looks like we have a neck where this head is not connected to the shoulder. It started to reveal itself. So just to show you, here's a lobe-finned fish. Here's an early limbed animal. Here's the new lobe-finned fish that we discovered in Jason's site. This is a creature. This is the front half of the creature. We have much of the back half now of a 4-foot-long specimen. Like a fish, it has scales in its back and fins with fin rays. And there's other features as well, some aspects of the shoulder and things like that. But like an early limbed animal, it has a flat head with eyes on top, elongate front end, short back end, neck. And when we opened up the fin, what did we find? We find bones that correspond to our shoulder, elbow, even portions of our wrist, found at the question mark in time. So it was and in fact, if you were to ask me in 1998 what kind of fish I would expect to find, I would tell you I would expect to find a flat-headed fish with thin rays that has a shoulder, elbow, and a wrist. So this is the creature here, just to show you. Like a lobe-finned fish, it has fins, scales, and primitive jaws. Like an early land animal, it has a bunch of features, wrists, neck, flat head, and ribs. Now, Farish and Ted and I, who were running the expeditions, were given the privilege of naming this thing. When you find a new species, you are given you have to give it a genus and a species name. And what we wanted was the creature to have a name that reflected its Inuit heritage. And so what we engaged in this case was the Inuit Council of Elders, that's these folks here, to come up with a name. And they had two charges here. One was to come up with a name that was meaningful to them and to us. And the second is a name we could pronounce. And the name of the committee did not lend a whole lot of confidence that we'd come up with a name we could pronounce. So I was talking to this guy here, and the challenge was coming up with a name that was meaningful. And so I tried to describe what we had. And he said, what do you got? So, we got a fish. It's in a rock. It's a fossil. They didn't have any concept for fossils. Hunters find fish in the water, not in the rocks. It was one of these things where there was a really disconnect between what we know as geologists and scientists and what their understanding is. Eventually got very frustrated with me, and he said, look, just tell me what it is and where it lived. I said, it's a large freshwater fish. He says, why don't you say so? You got yourself a tiktaalik. I said, tiktaalik, what's that? It's a large freshwater fish in our language. So that's what it was. Now, one of the things about tiktaalik is we had lots of specimens now, okay, and we can take them apart. And so this is one of the 9-footers. It looks horrible, and in fact, it is horrible, but it's the underside of a skull. You can see it's all beat up. Here's one jaw. Here's another jaw. You're looking at them like this. But it had an appendage in it. We could take the fin rays off, and in the fin rays, we started to find a humerus and a shoulder and so forth. So the preparators took out each bone of the fin in the round. And what we're able to do is to see what the fin looked like, that it had. If you look at your own limb, what do you have in the skeleton? One bone, two bones, series of a couple wrist joints, a proximal carpal joint, a distal carpal joint, and fingers. Well, here you have parts of that. You have, when you remove the webbing, you have one bone, humerus, two bones, a radius and ulna, another two bones, which actually compare to proximal wrist bones of amphibians, intermedium and ulnari, and then a series of transverse joints. We now know there are more bones out here. This is the reconstruction as it was in 2006. A series of transverse joints that are very similar to what we have in our wrist and fingers. And in fact, since we had the isolated bones, we could take these things out and look at the joints. And what we did is, here's the shoulder. We have a shoulder socket and a head on the humerus. We could look at the elbow. We could see how the shapes of these bones on the elbow fit together. So to see how the bones moved and glided one on the other. And we could do it all the way out from the shoulder to the elbow to the two wrist joints, the proximal and distal carpus. What this meant is, in putting them together and in trying to understand the shapes of the muscle processes that support the appendage, it's very clear that tiktaalik is able to do a form of a push-up. That is, the fin can function as a paddle with the fin rays, but also it's well set up to flex at the elbow and extend at the wrist. And there's even a little portion of a palm area with bones that could lie flush against the ground. So it's an animal that can support itself on its appendages. And so this is a reconstruction of what tiktaalik looked like as an animal that can support itself on its appendages. You have a large shoulder, that's sort of part fish, part amphibian. You have a fin with fin rays. You have a series of bones in there with a shoulder, elbow, and portions of a wrist. You have a flat head with eyes on top. You have a neck where the head can move independently of the body. You had both lungs and gills. I'll show you that in a second. And you had ribs, very massive ribs. Now, as an animal that's able to support its, that's supporting itself on its appendages, with a neck becomes very important. Because if you look at a lobe-finned fish, what you'll see is the head is fused to the shoulder. And there are a series of bones that connect the head to the shoulder. Some of them are bones that I haven't figured here, but the main ones that I'm showing you here are the opercular bones. You know the opercular flaps that you see on fish from time to time? If you look at a land-living animal, an early limbed animal, what you find is not only is the proportion of the head changing and the head is freed from the shoulder, but what you've done is largely done that through the loss of the opercular bones, as well as some other bones in here too. Tiktaalik has a neck with no operculum either. So Tiktaalik's a fish with both lungs and gills that's lost the operculum, and in fact all the opercular bones. Now in fish, the opercular bones tend to function as a pump which that pulls water across the gills. In Tiktaalik, you don't have that. So it's pretty clear Tiktaalik is breathing both water and air by gulping, which is a very sort of amphibian and lungfish-like way of respiring. So you can reconstruct Tiktaalik as a benthic animal, shallows, in the margins there, anywhere from the benthos to the shallows to the mudflats, as an animal that's able to support itself in that sort of continuum of environments by supporting itself, able to move its head and so forth. So basically the whole goal of the expedition was to find the sister group or the closest relative of tetrapods, and that's exactly what happened, found in the fossil record. Now, what I want to do is really to sort of think about how we pull all this together and what does it mean? And how do we link an understanding of fossils with an understanding of the sort of data we can pull from living creatures? What I have here is just to show you some limb bones. And you can see here's a chicken, and here's a chicken wing. You have one bone, two bones, and fingers. Here's a human, and you can see a human arm. One bone, two bones, wrist bones, and fingers. If you look at that one bone, two bone, wrist bone, finger pattern, that pattern is distinctive to all limbed animals and is different from all the fins that you see in creatures that are alive today. Here you see a lungfish, paddlefish, and so forth. And you can see these fins have fin rays, but they don't have bones that compare to that one bone, two bone pattern. This is where the fossils come into play, because these are the fossils, some I've talked about, here's Tiktaalik, others I haven't. It's really in the fossils you see the establishment of that one bone, two bone, finger bone pattern with the fin rays. So without them, we really wouldn't know the, in great detail the context in which these bones evolved. But what this is sort of set up was a bit of a puzzle for us, because the puzzle was, if you look at fish fins, they really don't have bones that look very similar to tetrapod limbs. And indeed, people trying to understand developmental biology in the 1990s, to understand the toolkit of genes that build fins and limbs, really came up with a notion, and I was one of them, that the sort of the DNA recipe that builds fins is very different from the DNA recipe that builds limbs. But the discovery of these fossils really suggests that perhaps the DNA recipe that builds limbs is already established in fins in some way. So basically the idea is that the discovery of fossils sort of forced us to look at the development of fins in a new way. And so let me just tell you what I mean by that. So remember I told you about the pattern of limbs? I'm showing it to you here. Remember that one bone, two bone, finger bone pattern? Well, I've drawn it here. One bone, two bones, finger bones pattern. If you look at this, or some of the key genes that are responsible for the formation of the pattern of this of these bones, one set of those genes are the so-called Hox genes, the five prime members of the Hox genes, the so-called D, A and of the A and D clusters. And what happens is the limb, as it develops, forms originally as a bud which extends out of the body. And as that bud extends out of the body, genes are turned on and off in characteristic ways. Okay? And it's these ways that these genes are turned on and off actually controls quite a bit of the developmental processes of the skeleton that's forming at this time. So some of these genes, these Hox genes that are formed, actually have a distinctive pattern of activity, which you can see here. And you can see each of these represents an individual gene. And you can see here they form a sort of a nested pattern of expression or activity. That is, this gene D13, its domain of activity, fits inside the domain of activity of D12. And together, these fit inside the domain of activity of D11. Together, all these fit inside the domain of activity of D10, and so forth, like Russian dolls. Turns out this pattern is very important for the development of this sort of one bone, two bone portion of the limb. If you play with these genes, if you knock them out, turn them off during development, during this phase of development, what you'll do is you'll affect this pattern of bones here. Then in later development, what you see is a pattern of activity that corresponds to the specification of the fingers. That you see that comes on later is a pattern of development where D13 actually extends very broadly across the appendage, and some of these others actually have D12 and D11, actually have domains that fit more or less within there. If you knock out these genes, if you mess with them in certain ways, you'll affect the formation of the fingers. So it appears that there's two phases of activity of these genes. One phase that's an early phase that's responsible for the formation of this one bone, two bone pattern, and a late phase pattern that's in part responsible for the formation of the fingers. Now, there are other genes involved here, but it's really these two phases that have very distinctive patterns of activity and also distinctive patterns of regulation. That is, the genetic controls of this late phase in limbed animals is very different from the genetic controls of this early phase. What does this all mean for evolution? The idea at the time, in the mid-90s, was that you have these two phases of development. And if we look at fish, sort of teleost fish, fin development, the idea was at the time was all they have is this first phase of activity. They don't have this late phase activity. So the hypothesis at the time was that fingers and wrists, their origin is related to this, to the origin of a new late phase pattern of activity. The fossils we're finding, from Tiktaalik to these other creatures which we were discovering at the time, which I'm not talking about, were really telling us that much of the sort of toolkit to build limbs is already present in fish fins. And so the idea that forced us to sort of look at fish fins to search for, maybe if we look in the right kind of fish, sort of primitive living fish, if you will, in some ways, maybe they will have this late phase pattern of gene activity in the fins. So what we decided to do was look at some of these fish in development, brought them in the lab, and begin to look at the patterns of activity of these genes that I was just showing you. And what we decided to do is look at this fish here, a paddlefish. We could get developmental series of these things. We'd get them from caviar farms in California and in Missouri. And this is the fin here of these creatures. And if we look at their development, what we could see is their fin bud grows out, and we can make little labels to see where these genes are active. And these are these genes, HOX D11, D12, and D13, and see how they form this lovely nested pattern I was telling you about, like the Russian dolls? So they have that early phase of expression. But lo and behold, as we looked at the later patterns of development, what you see is coming on very late, and in the terminal end of the appendage, is a late phase of these, much later actually, late phase of activity of these genes, where D13 actually has a very broad domain of expression, much broader than the other two. So the idea here was that as we look at fish fins, what we see is that they actually have portions of the toolkit that is responsible for the development of fingers and toes. And we really wouldn't have thought about it in the same way unless we had these fossils in the first place, because it was the fossils that led us to really look at the development of fish fins in a different way. Finally, I want to talk about another thing that living fish tell us about, and that's their breathing. If you look at fish that are alive today, they have evolved many different patterns of breathing. They breathe air. In fact, if you look at fish that are alive today, there are at least 375 different species of air-breathing fish. They exist in 49 different families, and there may be 24, probably a whole lot more, cases of a different evolution of air breathing. And when fish evolve air breathing, they evolve the ability to breathe, to gulp air in their mouth. They vascularize their mouth. Common strategy, in fact, very primitive strategy for fish, is lungs. In fact, lungs actually first arose in fish to help them breathe in anoxic water, water that's depleted of oxygen, not to help them live on land. So you see, if you look at the evolution of air breathing, there are many different strategies that fish use to breathe air. Lungs are actually a very primitive one. In fact, look at Tiktaalik and its relatives on this tree. They're actually all the way up here. So lungs evolved well before Tiktaalik and its cousins ever hit the scene. And lungs didn't evolve to enable creatures to live on land. Lungs actually arose to help creatures live in water, and with both gills and lungs to help them breathe and gulp air when the oxygen in the water becomes depleted. Anyway, what I'm basically saying is we can discover fossils that tell us about the intermediate conditions between life in water and life on land, but we can also look at living creatures to get a sense of how their physiologies have evolved to enable this transition to happen, and also look at their genetics to see the conditions that allowed their morphologies to evolve. So basically, the notion of urinary fish is the idea that this transition from life in water to life on land isn't just some esoteric event in the history of life. The transition from life in water to life on land is actually an important event in our own history. That is, when I'm talking about the origin of a neck in a creature like Tiktaalik, this is something that's to become our own neck. When I talk about the origin of a wrist in a creature like Tiktaalik, this is something that over a long period of time is to become our own wrist. So captured in this transition from fish to land-living animal is a piece of our own distant past, when our common ancestor was fish, were fish. Now, when I was working on Tiktaalik and we were digging it out, I was actually teaching human anatomy at the University of Chicago Medical School. And I was trained as an anatomist, actually, in graduate school, and I thought nothing of teaching human anatomy, other than the amount of work that was involved with it. Now, you may know human anatomy is an incredibly time-consuming course. This is where medical students see the human body for the first time in a cadaver, and they learn tens of thousands of new names and anatomical structures. And you spend a lot of time with the medical students around the tables in laboratory talking. And I remember those first few weeks in the class, the students would come up to me and they'd say, "Dr. Shubin, what kind of doctor are you?" And they'd say, "Are you a surgeon? Are you a cardiologist?" And I'd say, "Well, no, I'm a fish paleontologist." And I'd be like, "What? Are you crazy? I mean, what is going on with that?" What seemed so strange actually was very powerful. That is, it turns out that being a paleontologist, and not only a paleontologist, but being a fish paleontologist, is a powerful way to teach and learn human anatomy. And the reason for that is many of the basic roadmaps for our fundamental architecture of our body, the way our limbs are put together, the way our limbs are put together in our bodies, the basic structure of our brain and nervous system and development were originally set up in fish. And so I like to, if you look at human anatomy, you can look at the head, for instance, and one of the most stressful portions of human anatomy is actually the head. Because somewhere halfway through the class, the students look at the syllabus, and they realize the whole second half of the class is on the head. There's as much anatomy from the neck up as there is from the neck down. It's a terrifying thought. And when you think about all that anatomy is packed in a little box, you have 12 cranial nerves, okay? And this is one of those cranial nerves, the trigeminal. And look at all the names. And it's like a tangled piece of fishing line in a box. But actually, the best way to understand these things is to think of history, to think of our evolutionary history and our developmental history. So much so that, you may look at Albert Einstein here, and some people may see him as the pinnacle of creation. I tend to look at it differently. I look at Einstein, like all other humans, as some sort of crazy, morphed out fish. And it's helpful to compare Professor Einstein to the fish. Professor Einstein's on your left here. If you look at the head area. A few weeks after conception in a human embryo, this is what the head area begins to look like as it gains its form. You have a pair of primordia of eyes, and you see a series of paired swellings that appear in the behind the eyes. And then a series of clefts which separate those swellings. Those swellings swell because they contain lots of cells. Some of those cells are dividing in situ in place, and other cells are actually migrating to those locations. Look at any creature of the head. Why not look at a shark? Here's a shark. It's the same but different. Looks a little bit different, but has the same basic architecture. A pair of eyes. These are the primordia, seen slightly later in development. And look at this. You see these swellings as well, these paired swellings. This is the first one shown in light blue, the second one shown in purple, the green one, yellow one, and so forth, all separated by a little cleft. There's an internal structure to them and so forth. You can ask the question, well, what happens to the cells inside these swellings? Well, let's look at the shark first. You follow these cells. This first one, this light blue one, some of those cells differentiate to become portions of the upper and lower jaws and portions of the arteries, muscles, and nerves that support them and supply them. Other ones become portions of the gill supporting series, as well as a portion here which supports the skull. What happens in humans? Here's those same arches. First arch becomes portion of the lower jaw and two bones in our middle ear. The second one becomes a portion of a bone that supports parts of our throat and tongue, as well as a bone in our middle ear, a portion of our skull. The others become portions of our voice box and throat bones. What does this mean, this comparison? Well, in a developmental sense, this means some of the muscles and nerves and bones I'm using to talk to you with right now, and some of the muscles and nerves and bones you're using to hear me with right now, correspond to the gill bones of fish. Now, you could say, well, that's just development. But this development makes a specific prediction about what we should see in the fossil record. That is, according to this, I should see the transition from a jawbone to ear bones in the fossil record, and gill bones and a head-supporting bone to an ear bone as well. And that's exactly what we see in the fossil record. Here's your three little mirror. You have inside your ear, you have three little ear ossicles. This one here, the stapes. We can follow a transformation from a gill bone and all the way to a bone which supports the back of the skull in creatures like Tiktaalik to the stapes in the ear. That's exactly the transformation you'd expect from development. Likewise, if we look at the fossils, we see a transformation from jaw bones to ear bones. So basically, in your ear contains a small portion of the tree of life, the transition from fish to amphibian, and the transition from reptile-like creatures to mammals. And that's seen in the fossils, that's seen in the development, and what I haven't showed you, it's seen in the DNA recipe that builds your ears and gills of fish. It's a remarkable story, and the beauty of the story is in the way the evidence comes together to support something as crazy as where your ear comes from. Anyway, with that, I'd like to close. You can ask the question, you know, who cares about our connection? It's an important question to always ask. Who cares about our connection, you know, to life on the planet? You know, who cares? So my ears are like from a shark or whatever. Who cares about, you know, fish fins and human limbs? But, you know, it turns out the importance, you know, working scientists take is entirely trivial, but it's absolutely sublime and profound. If you look at the Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology in the last 20 years, who have they gone to? What researchers have they gone to? They've gone to people working on flies, sea slugs, yeast, sea urchins. In fact, two Nobel Prizes in the last 7 years have gone to five people working on Caenorhabditis elegans, a little tiny worm the size of a comma on a piece of paper. Yet that worm is telling us how our cells die, but it's also telling us about how our genes are silenced and how they can be turned off in health and disease. Drug companies are very interested in technologies derived from this little worm. You know, I like to think that as we discover cures to everything that ails us, from Alzheimer's to various cancers, that work will ultimately be derived in some way from yeast, sea urchins, flies, and in some cases, even fish. I can't imagine a more powerful statement about the connection of us to the rest of life on our planet than that. Thank you very much.
This has to be a very expensive research. Where do you get your funding?
Yeah, so, good point. I spend 5 days at home for every day in the field, you know, writing grants, permits, packing food, and that kind of thing. So the hat is being passed, by the way. It's starting in the back there, so somewhere in the back row. We have about five different sources of money. So National Geographic Society provides a small grant. National Science Foundation, government provides a small grant. Private donors provide small grant. You know, families provide gifts. University of Chicago provides some. I mean, it's a hat that's filled with, you know, from our institutions, granting agencies, and so forth. And we felt the fragility of that last summer when oil prices were high. You know, they're approaching the barrel, $150 a barrel. Turns out, in the interval between when we did our budget requests and when we had to leave for the field, oil had doubled in price and the U.S. dollar had cratered versus the Canadian dollar, so we all of a sudden didn't have enough money. Fortunately, everything righted itself by the time I had to pay the bills. Could have been pretty bad. But yeah, I spent a lot of time trying to raise it. It's very expensive. So like a helicopter up there costs $2,500 an hour. And we're easily a two-hour ride from, a five-hour ride, 2.5 hours each way from to the base.
You framed much of this work in terms of looking backwards and filling in gaps. But you mentioned in passing the Dover case, and it seems to me that one important lesson from this is the absence of looking forward. That is, there's no teleology in here. All of these adaptations are kludges that are pieced together from things that performed another function in advance. And I wonder how you address the challenge of explaining to people, a lay audience, that what looks to be a miraculous design is in fact a compilation of features that were doing something completely different in a previous species.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because you know, if you look at Tiktaalik, it's a very successful shallow freshwater benthic animal. And it's in that context it's evolving features that would later be used by its descendants for life on land. And so, you know, you think that's why when I showed Tiktaalik, it's not looking out of the water to walk on land. It's living its life in the shallows and in the benthos. And it's there where, you know, many tetrapod features come about. And, you know, in fact, I like to think about it as a tree of life, a tangled bank. You know, use the Darwinian images of, you know, life in these streams brings about many different strategies. And a few of these strategies are ones that whose descendants actually lived on land. But we think about the lung as a great example. I mean, so many of these features we think teleologically. Lungs evolved to enable animals to walk on land. Arms and legs evolved to enable animals to walk on land. But the reality is when you look at the fossil record and you look at the living creatures, what you see is lungs and limbs and so many basic pieces of us actually evolved in fish living in aquatic ecosystems, you know, exploiting their own environments. And I think, the key thing here is not thinking of, you know, transformation series, you know, how, you know, the classic cartoons of transformation, but thinking in terms of evolutionary trees. That's the powerful shift, I think.
In a recent issue of the National Geographic, there was a very interesting article about the ownership of fossils and legal disputes among the fossil hunters. So who owns your fish?
Yeah, there's no legal dispute about this one. This is owned by the Inuit. So, yeah, they own everything we find. And everything's going back to Canada in 2 years.
Just like the Getty and the Greek sculptures, right?
Yeah, there's a reason why I've cast these. So we're casting these things like crazy before they go back. But the deal is they own everything. And so everything's going back to Ottawa, the Canadian Museum of Nature. And they're going to stay there until such time the Inuit have the ability to build a museum in Iqaluit to house this.
What's the next question you want answered?
Yeah, so, you know, the joke is, you know, you found Tiktaalik, you created two new gaps in the fossil record. So what we're in fact, last year, we returned to the Tiktaalik site, but only for a week, to pull out some we knew were there. But we went to Younger Rock to look for Tiktaalik 2.0. You know, a creature that has more, you know, Tiktaalik doesn't have real fingers. I'd like to see a creature with more finger-like structures appearing there. But then my other goal is to go much deeper, and that's what we're starting now, is to look at the origin of jawed vertebrates, which is something that happened much, much more in much more ancient strata. And so we're looking at Ordovician and Silurian age rocks way deeper in time. The good news is they're preserved in abundance in the Arctic. The bad news is they're preserved in abundance in the Arctic.
Okay, on that note, I think we'll end the evening right there, and thank Neil again for a great talk.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.